journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news, analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, January 29, 2009. Sitting in for Sonali Kahatkar, I'm Maria Armudian.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
I didn't mean to dust it off or play it back. Once again, I tried too hard to cross the tracks. Sorry if my eyes drop when the fellow meadows out. But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. In this hour, the House passes Obama's economic stimulus plan. We'll look at what's in the bill, the politics behind the bill, and what's next. Plus, an in-depth conversation on the psychology of resolving global conflict. Finally, Battle Hymn, a new play. Pregnant with history. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Yesterday, the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives voted to pass President Barack Obama's $816 billion economic stimulus plan, one of the largest in history. The bill passed by 244 to 188 votes. Although Democrats had accommodated some of Republicans' concerns, all of the Republicans and 11 Democrats voted against it. In the House, Republicans called for more tax cuts, particularly those aimed at housing and a small business capital gains tax break. President Obama had supported those ideas as a candidate. But in the midst of an ongoing recession and more news of massive layoffs, President Obama urged expediency in bringing the legislation to his desk, declaring, quote, "We don't have a moment to spare," end quote. Obama and his supporters in the House contend that the stimulus package, investing in infrastructure, education, and middle-class tax credits, is sufficient to begin lifting the economy out of recession. The bill now moves to the Senate, where the bill will likely be amended and reach an even higher price tag. Once the Senate decides on its version of the plan, the two houses will have to reconcile any differences. Joining us now from Washington to help us understand the plan and the politics is John Irons. He's the Research and Policy Director at the Economic Policy Institute. Welcome, John Irons.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. Thank you. So let's start with what is actually in this bill. There's a big piece of it that deals with unemployment and Medicaid. Why don't you start us there and talk more about what we've got?
Yeah, well, the bill right now, as it's gone through the House of Representatives, and it'll change before it finally gets passed, is large. It's over $800 billion. It includes money in there for some tax reductions. There's money in there for some direct job creation through infrastructure and other projects. There's some assistance to people who have been hardest hit by the recession in terms of some expansion to health care, some protections for people who have lost their jobs. And there's money in there for a variety of other purposes as well. It's a large package, and it has a number of provisions to really try to have a comprehensive approach to tackling this recession.
Well, let's start with some of these things and look at them a little bit more in detail, because some of the areas that I understand that the Republicans are balking at are things like health care. They're saying they're terrified that this is a step towards the single-payer universal health care. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I think their criticisms are somewhat unfounded. I think there is, on the health side, there are two or three big provisions. One provision is assistance to states to help fully fund their Medicaid obligations. That's health care for low-income individuals. And states, as you know, are having a heck of a time trying to match together their revenues and their outlays, because they're seeing, as a result of the recession, their revenues really take a dive, and they're being forced to cut back on any number of different spending areas, including on health care. So part of what's in the bill is an attempt to really make states whole, that they don't have to cut back on those services. Now, there's other parts of it, too, including some money in there to help states and help hospitals turn their medical records from paper into electronic form. which really is an investment in making the healthcare system a little bit more efficient. I think there are broader healthcare issues that we'll need to tackle, but this stimulus package only scratches the surface on that.
Now, I understand that the largest long-term investment is really this $50 billion for energy efficiency. Can you talk a little bit about this? This is also for government buildings, for low-income housing, and expanding the electric grid. What do you know about that?
Yeah, this really is a down payment on more fundamental reforms of our energy systems. There's money in there to help modernize and make more energy efficient government buildings. The federal government operates a lot of buildings around the country, and making those more energy efficient would both create jobs now, but would also lower the government's energy bill down the road. So I think that's a very good long-term investment. But there's also incentives in there for private companies to help weatherize and modernize, like you said, low-income households, but to provide other general incentives to create new clean energy so that we don't have to rely quite so much on oil that we know we need to wean ourselves off of. So it's a mixture of incentives for private companies as well as for, the government to do what it ought to be doing anyway.
Now, that I'm thinking is also aimed at creating a whole new industry.
That's the hope. The hope is that the government can be catalyst here. It's not going to make all the decisions about exactly what kinds of energy are wind versus solar versus biofuels. But the federal government can be a catalyst. It can ensure that some of these markets develop. It can really take a long step towards ensuring that we have, for example, the capacity in terms of our electrical grid to transmit the energy from the deserts of Arizona, where there's a lot of sun, to other places which are going to use the energy. We know we need to modernize our electrical grid, and we know we need better incentives in place to develop clean energy and clean fuels. So this really is an attempt to jumpstart a market, to jumpstart a new energy environment, which we really need to do.
Now, one of the things Republicans also, I understand, balked at was this concern that extraordinarily wealthy people would be able to get this Medicaid and that would just be throwing money out the window. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that's silly. Medicaid right now is very much targeted at very low-income individuals and families. There is some attempt by some states to go beyond simply the definition of the poverty level to maybe 200% of poverty. But the idea that you're going to have very wealthy individuals taking Medicaid is, I think, not a very well-founded concern. This still is a very targeted program. And I think when you look at the broader healthcare system, there's legitimate questions about how we design a system to ensure that people have access to affordable healthcare, affordable high-quality healthcare. And so I think, as the Obama administration moves on, they're going to be taking a look at broader healthcare issues. On this particular issue that's in the stimulus package now, this is something that is essential and incredibly important for people who have lost their jobs and who have therefore lost their health insurance. We need to stimulate the economy. And if you have people who are spending what little income they have left on healthcare, that's not going to be good for the overall economy. So this really is an attempt to make sure the people who are hardest hit by the downturn will have money to keep themselves afloat and help stimulate the economy.
I just want to remind our listeners that we are speaking with John Irons, who is the Research and Policy Director at the Economic Policy Institute. Just this morning, the Labor Department released some numbers that look like it's much worse than anybody expected. Can you speak to that and what we're actually facing?
Yeah, well, it looks like when you look at all the labor market indicators, both the numbers released today, but also numbers that we've been seeing for the last several months, the labor market and the economy generally is in very bad shape. We've seen 2.5 million jobs lost over the last year. We're seeing that trend get worse, not get better at the current time. We've seen the unemployment rate already tick up by over 2 percentage points, which is the largest one-year increase since the 1970s. And so if you look at the projections going forward, people are projecting a fairly miserable 2009, continuing job losses, unemployment rate potentially hitting 10% if nothing is done, which is a really bad economic environment to be looking for a job or be someone who's in the labor market. We're seeing companies who are foregoing pay increases. You're seeing incomes stagnating, if not falling, and you're seeing people being increasingly put at risk for losing their job. And so it's a kind of thing where you're hearing some urgency on this, which is completely justified. We're really looking at a very bleak situation if nothing is done.
Now, here in California, we're already almost at 10%, actually. It's getting very close. It's in the nines. So I'm wondering now, if this is to pass and goes to the Senate version will potentially go up to $900 billion because of this alternative minimum tax adjustment. What do you know about that?
Well, the alternative minimum tax adjustment is, this is a fairly arcane part of tax law, but if there is no adjustment made, you will see millions of people who would face an additional tax burden as a result. This is the kind of provision that Congress, for various reasons, passes 1 year at a time. It's a fairly expensive change to make, but Congress does tend to act on this every year. Whether this is part of the stimulus package or something else, it'll get done. So I think it's one of those cases where you can put it as part of the package or you can leave it out. If it serves to get some more votes on the package, fine, so be it. But it's really not something that's very controversial. It's going to happen anyway. Whether or not it happens part of the stimulus package is not that important.
Now, since all of the Republicans voted against this bill in the House, and including 11 Democrats, and the Senate is a little bit more of a balance, what are you foreseeing to come out of the Senate, and do you expect something to move fairly quickly?
Well, that's a very good question. I think a lot of people were surprised that it got absolutely no Republican support in the House. Now, the Senate is a different animal. And the question that I think a lot of the Senate Republicans are going to have to face is, am I going to be the one who's going to stop this train from going down the tracks? Because they're faced with the possibility that if Republicans want to stick together on this, they're going to have to filibuster the stimulus package. And that could have devastating consequences for the economy. The economy really does need this shot in the arm. And I think it's a different kind of experience for some of the Senate Republicans to be the one who is standing up and holding this bill from passage. So I expect that there may be a couple minor tweaks done to the bill, but I suspect that it'll get through in the end. Now, of course, they then have to reconcile the Senate version with the House version, and who knows what happens when they get around to trying to reconcile the two. But I expect that it'll go through the Senate fairly quickly.
Now, the Republicans are calling for tax cuts, and your organization suggests that we've been there, done that, didn't work. Explain.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've tried various different kinds of tax cuts, both earlier last year, but also in 2001 and 2003. Now, it's very important to mention that not all tax cuts are equal. Some of the tax cuts that are in this bill, I think, are perfectly reasonable. There are tax cuts that are targeted at low and moderate income families who are the most likely to need the tax break, and to go out and spend it right away to really help out the economy. So there are some tax cuts that are very valuable and would help to stimulate the economy. Now, a lot of the tax cuts that are being advocated for amongst primarily Republicans are tax cuts for corporations who right now don't really need a tax cut because they don't have customers. They need customers first. Giving them a tax break on non-existent profits is not going to help out the economy a whole lot. So, it's our opinion that some of the tax cuts, if they are targeted at low and moderate income families, could be a valuable stimulus. But some of the tax cuts which are targeted primarily at corporations who need customers will be fairly ineffective at stimulating the economy.
Now, one last question here. We're just about out of time. Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, has made it clear in his remarks to reporters that the Obama administration will not nationalize banks.
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I think they're trying to investigate a number of different options for solving this financial market crisis that's been going on for, close to 4 or 5 months now. My guess is that we will not see nationalization the way some European countries have done it, in Sweden and the United Kingdom. We will probably forge our own way. But I think it's going to be clear that no matter, what words you use to describe it, we the people, we taxpayers, are going to own a pretty sizable chunk of a lot of banks in a lot of other financial institutions around the country. And so I think it makes sense uh, as you would kind of care about how the companies in your stock portfolio perform, I think we as taxpayers are going to have to take a very strong interest in how financial markets are performing and how they are lending. We have a right as now new shareholders to demand that they expand lending and help the economy get going again. So I think there will be increasingly, an increasing involvement in financial markets. Whether or not you want to call that nationalization or not, I think is not as important as how we actually steward our investments.
Well, John Irons, I want to thank you so much for joining us here.
Well, thank you.
John Irons is the Research and Policy Director of the Economic Policy Institute, and you can find out more at www.epi.org. And just a reminder that you are listening to Uprising. I'm Maria Armudian, and I'm filling in for Sonali Kolhatkar. Later in the hour, we're going to be joined in studio by the playwright and the actors from a historic fantasy called Battle Hymn. And then after today's Subversive Historian, we're going to have an in-depth discussion about the psychology of resolving global conflict.
This is Gabriel San Román, your subversive historian. 146 years ago, on this day in people's history, the Bear River Massacre occurred. On January 29, 1863, hundreds of volunteer militiamen from California attacked northwestern Shoshone Indians camped along the convergence of Bear River and Beaver Creek. Prior to the violence, white Mormon farmers had encroached on Shoshone lands along the present-day Utah-Idaho border, impoverishing them of their resources. Westward expansionism was then the root of the ensuing Shoshone attacks on farms and ranches as a means of survival. After a series of incidents, Colonel Patrick Edward Conard was called upon by Utah territorial authorities to take action. The bloodshed that followed ended in the deaths of at least 250 Shoshones. The massacre was heinous as Shoshone women were raped and children were brutalized by the marauding militiamen. Having taken place during the Civil War, the murderous history of Bear River has been all too often disregarded, much as the bodies of its victims were as they were left to rot on the field. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our history.
The 20th century has been deemed the bloodiest of all by scholars, with more than 60 million people, possibly 100 million people, killed at the hands of government decrees and enacted by both civilians and soldiers. The United States is still engaged in two wars, and Israel just killed more than 1,200 Palestinians in its Gaza incursion. War rages on in Darfur, the Congo, and throughout the planet. Some believe that the election of Barack Obama signals a new turn towards less violence, less war, and more dialogue. So how do we resolve violent conflict, particularly when they are deeply, deeply acrimonious? What are the assumptions that we just might have to let go of? We're going to begin this dialogue here with scholars and thinkers who are asking and answering these questions. Today, we've got three such scholars and thinkers. We've got Mari Fitstuff, who is professor and director of the International Program in Coexistence and Conflict at Brandeis University. She's authored a number of books, including the award-winning Beyond Violence, Conflict Resolution Processes in Northern Ireland, and is co-editor of the three-volume The Psychology of Resolving Global Conflict, From War to Peace. Welcome, Mari Fitstuff.
Hello, everyone.
Great to have you. We've got Douglas Fry also, who studies peaceful societies. Douglas Fry has written a number of books, including Beyond War and the Human Potential for Peace and Peaceful Societies. Welcome, Douglas Fry.
Thank you very much. We're glad to be here.
Great to have you. And Douglas Knoll, he's a lawyer, he's a mediator, and he specializes in peacemaking. He's written several books, including Peacemaking, Practicing at the Intersection of Law and Human Conflict. Welcome, Douglas Knoll.
Welcome. Thank you.
Great to have you all. So what I'd like to do, I think, is to start with Mari Fitstuff. You co-edited this volume, and we're starting with human nature and our assumptions about human nature and how those play into conflict or peace. So let's really begin this with the very premise of what is natural to humanity. Conflict, competition, why don't you start there?
It's very interesting, Maria, and I'm sure that my two colleagues on the other end of the line have this experience as well. But if you're at a party and somebody asks you what you do, and you say you're working in international conflict, you often find people roll their eyes up to heaven and say, you can never do anything about that. It's natural to human nature. And I think the reason for pulling these three volumes together was actually to see what the reality about that statement was. Is it so natural that we do give up the idea that we can change things? Or is it something about the context, something we can actually affect? And I think that we were really interested in hearing from the best in the field the actual truth about whether or not it's natural. I know some of my colleagues will be talking about it, but, you know, essentially I think we're coming to the conclusion that there are some tendencies we do have to be aware of, that those tendencies within particular contexts can be used by leaders, and that there are very many things that we can actually change about our environment and our context that can make sure any tendencies we have towards aggression or violence can actually be balanced out with other possibilities.
Let's bring in Doug Fry. Doug Fry, you have been writing and studying peaceful societies, and you assert that the fact they exist really means that, no, conflict is not natural to human beings. Why don't you tell us about some of these societies first?
Societies are very interesting for several reasons, and one is that their very existence shows that it is possible to create a social organization where people behave and resolve their conflicts nonviolently. Also, between different societies, some of these peaceful societies are also non-warring societies. So this also shows that humans don't make war everywhere and always, which of course pertains very centrally to your questions about human nature. So peaceful societies, I want to first of all point out that for the chapter for Mari's book, it's co-authored by Bruce Bonta. And Bruce Bonta, I call him sometimes Mr. Peaceful Society. He became interested in these societies some years ago and has a website that is very interesting, just filled with good information. So I want to plug the website and make sure that anybody who's really interested in pursuing this, it's a great place to start. It's www.peacefulsocieties.org. But in terms of what peaceful societies really tell us in regards to human nature, if there was something in human nature that forced us or pushed us towards making war, then we really would expect to see this across cultures. So the fact that there are non-warring societies sort of begins to break this down. But the next issue is to look and see, are there some commonalities that we might find about the non-warring societies? And this is a ripe area for research. But one thing that's come out very clearly is that it does relate to complexity or simplicity of social organization. So there are different types of societies, but the type that goes back over 99-point-something% of our human and pre-human history would be a very simple type of band society, where the people live in small groups, 25 to 50 people perhaps, sometimes smaller, usually not larger, and they're nomadic. The women and the men do have different ways of focusing on making a living, so to speak. The women are gathering tubers, plants, nuts, and so forth for the most part, although they may, if opportunity arises, you know, kill small animals. Whereas the men are hunting. What's very interesting about this type of social organization is it can provide us a model of human nature, roughly, if we look across these different societies and try to pull out generalities. And one thing I've done in my research is to do exactly this, and it comes out that most of these simple nomadic bands do not make war. And so that's an intriguing finding as you're thinking about human nature.
Yeah, there are a couple of things. There are a couple of things that you. One thing that you mentioned, and a couple that were in the chapter, I wanted to actually have you contrast. One is that these societies that you just described are not industrial societies, and then there are two other things that you said in the book. One is that the violence is determined by their value system and worldview. And then the third thing, which I want you to bring in after, is the dismissing of peaceful societies in this industrial society. So why don't you address those, and then we'll move on into some of the other factors here.
Okay. I'll give it my best shot. You're asking three very interesting types of questions here. I want to point out, yes, of course, most of the peaceful societies are rather small scale, but there are even countries such as Norway, for instance, that has got a very peaceful orientation. Costa Rica, after World War II, basically gave up their army, and so they could be considered a non-warring society. Norway does participate in defensive maneuvers and so forth. They're not exactly non-warring, but they have a real emphasis on peace internationally and domestically. So there are large groups that also are very peaceful. Let's see, your second... What was the second topic that you wanted me to...
Oh, about you have said in your chapter that they're determined by their values and worldview.
Yes, yes, very much so. And I think this has got a real relevant lesson as you know, you think about any society, including the United States, and how we view war. There are studies that have been done that link attitudes about human nature to activities for peace and engaging in activities for peace and demonstrations and such. And there is a negative correlation here in the sense that if you view that humans are naturally warlike or have instincts for aggression and this sort of thing, then you're less likely to actually engage in pro-peace activities. So unfortunately, what we can get here is a self-fulfilling type of prophecy where people view human nature as naturally aggressive, humanity as warlike, so it's not motivating them to think about alternatives or to take action for peace. So what we find in the peaceful societies, in the non-warring societies, they really have different beliefs. And this is something that the people reiterate in their daily conversations. For instance, this group of Xingu, Upper Xingu River Valley tribes that live in a non-warring system. And there's 10 tribes. This is in Brazil. And no war has been reported amongst these tribes for well over 100 years at this point. And the attitudes that come in is they look at aggression as something that is just showing a lack of control. And this is bad. People should be in control of their emotions and activities. And so they also think of someone who loses control as basically, well, they put him down, they criticize him, gossip about him, and so on. So these are elements of values that help to reinforce an attitude that you shouldn't be aggressive or shouldn't be a warrior.
Well, let's bring in Doug Knoll now. Now, Doug Knoll, you actually look at the role of these neurochemicals, and you're saying, you know, most of human behavior is not even conscious, and that these neurochemicals and subconscious urges are actually a big part of what's driving conflict and maybe non-conflict.
Well, it's more the neurochemistry. It's also the neurophysiology of the brain and the central nervous system. But I think that what we know, the knowledge base that it's expanding about the brain and social neuroscience is expanding extraordinarily rapidly from where we were in the mid-90s. And more neuroscientists are beginning to study topics such as emotionality, aggression, decision-making, the role of executive function, how impaired brains are involved in bad decision making, and a lot of really interesting and salient information is coming out of this research that's directly applicable to understanding conflict, and most particularly for what I'm interested in is the direct application of process and practice in the actual art of peacemaking. So what we know is that we're 98% emotional and 2% rational, and almost every decision that a human engages in has an emotional overtone. Sometimes that emotionality is understated, but most of the time it is overstated. And in conflict, of course, certain areas of the brain are stimulated primarily in the amygdalic regions of the brain, which are two small little almond-shaped processes in the forebrain. And as Dr. Fitzduff said earlier, I think it was the Johnson article noted that our upbringing is important here because it's upbringing that determines how the brain is actually physically developed.
Talk about that. How does that work?
Well, the human from the time the human brain starts to form in gestation until about 18 months. There's actually a requirement that a child go through both natal and neonatal or postnatal, has to go through certain life experiences that the caregiver has to provide in order for the brain to form properly and to process properly. And if those opportunities are missed, the brain will never ever develop properly, and there is no way to correct it. I am under the belief right now that all crime is nothing more than, and violence for that matter, is primarily caused by dysfunctions in the brain caused by early childhood development. Now, that's a pretty broad statement, and you also have to recognize that this kind of behavior goes across a continuum, but there's some amazing research.
Quick question on that. Can they be corrected once?
No.
So once damaged?
That's the problem. You can do some behavioral correction, of course, and some of the problems can be modulated by drugs, but we have plenty of examples of severe dysfunction where people really cannot function normally, and that's the sad part, and that's why we really need to, if we want peace in this world, we have to be investing in the children, and we have to make sure that from the time a mother becomes pregnant and until a child is at least 4 or 5 years old, that child is showered in love. I mean, that's the answer.
It sounds trite and weird,
but that is exactly what has to happen.
Mari Fitzstuff, go ahead and come in.
One of the most fascinating things for me was I lived in an area in Northern Ireland that was actually called the Killing Fields because the murders between the two sides were the second highest in any area in Northern Ireland. At the same time, there was never a theft in that community. There was never a rape. There was never a murder. The paramilitaries who were out at night often took care of the children, taught them music, etc. So somehow they had been taught that violence against the other group simplified the other, and a violence against the other group was okay. But the maintenance of their own community and the behavior within the community was actually almost impeccable, so much so that at the same time as Northern Ireland had a war going on, it had the lowest crime rate Western Europe.
Fascinating.
So somehow these children had learned communal murders are okay. Individual, even striking, even beating, even not looking after old people was not okay. So this does, to a certain extent, I think, point us back to the context within which these people grew up, where
Absolutely.
They were given a value that valued intra-community building and caring, but did not value, obviously, extra outside external caring.
Actually, Doug Fry, if we could bring you in on this, too, because I think you noted that some of these peaceful groups also talk about, I think there was a quote about why white man was so angry that one of the groups said, is because of the mistreatment of the children. So child rearing is a huge role.
Yes, and I can speak very well on this from my own research as well, which I did a number of years ago in Oaxaca, Mexico, comparing two Zapotec communities, the ethnic group, that were side by side and in other ways extremely similar. But what I did was I very systematically observed children's behavior, 24 children in one community and 24 children in the other, did it on a random rotation, and just recorded how the children were interacting with each other and with the adults, what type of socialization was going on, and all types of behaviors. The other thing, then, is to compare the actual aggression in the two communities. Well, the place which I call La Paz lives up to its name, certainly. There's rather a small amount of adult aggression. It's rare to see men get into a fight, rare still to see women exchange. In fact, I don't believe I ever saw women get into a physical altercation in this community of La Paz. If you look at the homicide rate in La Paz and compare it with the other community, which I refer to as San Andreas, in San Andreas, there's a higher murder rate, about 5 times higher. You will see fist fights at a fairly common intervals. And in the course of my field work in these two communities, I saw 3 wife beatings going on in San Andreas, none in La Paz, and so on and so on. So the point is you've got two very different communities in terms of the accepted amount of aggression and the actual observable amount of aggression, and these are forming in some way, so the theory goes, a learning environment for the children.
So they're
this is, in fact, just to give you the heart of the children data, this is exactly what I found. The children in the 3 years to 8 years age range were already much more aggressive in San Andreas than they were in La Paz. So social learning, socialization, punishment of the children, these are things which the peaceful societies generally suggest are very important in developing children who are either aggressive or non-aggressive, and then certainly it dovetails with the specific example I've been talking about from Mexico as well.
While we've still got you, Mari Fitzstuff, I'd also like you to address the chapter about humiliation, particularly because we don't have that author here, but he had specifically said that humiliation overrides the fear of death.
That was written by a woman called Evan Linder. And yes, I mean, one of the things that really is worrying is that people do not understand. If you read the stories of any of the paramilitaries in Sri Lanka, Palestinians, Northern Ireland, ETA, what you realize is that their choice does not seem to be rational. It is only rational if you understand it in terms of their needs and the need to be respected, the need to be understood, the need to prove meaning in your life, the need for a young man to prove that he can be a hero. All of these transcend rationality. And I think the chapter on humiliation is a very good one because it shows that those kinds of feelings that actually can be addressed in us, particularly by, if you look at a situation, for instance, like Gaza, what happens to people who are at the end of a situation like that, who are the victims of a situation like that? It can be that they become completely enraged, completely caught up in trying to redress that kind of humiliation, and a war continues to go on, not just in Gaza, but in so many of our conflicts around the world.
Let me bring Doug Fry in just really quickly. Again, we're actually going to run out of time in about 3.5 minutes. But I wonder, how do peaceful societies continue on in keeping these themselves peaceful, and how do they protect themselves from warring societies?
Well, this brings in the idea of this peace system, which I think I mentioned just briefly at the beginning, that one thing that can keep societies peaceful is if the neighboring societies are all part of a union. We see examples of this anthropologically, for instance, on the Labrador Peninsula, the original hunting-gathering groups there, they existed in small bands, and they never made war on each other.
But we don't have that in society today that much.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm going to jump all the way to the European Union. And this, I would argue, is a peace system freshly created and still in the process of being augmented. You know, after World War II, French thinkers and other German thinkers and politicians came up with the idea of the central problem, really, how can we prevent another major war on the continent? And through a whole series of political steps over decades, literally, they created this brand new regional entity, this polity. And it's been, if anything else, totally successful in making the war threat basically go down to nil. So nobody expects, anticipates that there would be a war within the European community. And I mentioned the Xingu tribes also. That's another peace system. Occasionally they've had to defend themselves from the groups on the outside, and that is a problem. I mean, this is something that either you get run over, you get driven away, or you defend yourself. I think the European Union holds such an important lesson for the planet overall. I mean, granted, it's much more complex when you're talking about the entire globe and societies that are so very different compared to Europe that although it has diversity socially and culturally, there are some similarities in common histories and so forth. But again, we think back to what happened in World War II and where we are today.
Right. Doug, I'm going to interrupt you just because we've got about a minute and a half left, and I wanted Doug Knoll and Mari Fitzstuff to each get to say a little bit as well, just to sort of conclude. So, Doug Knoll, why don't you?
I think that what we conclude in this, what turned out to be a pretty amazing three-volume piece of work, is that people who are engaged in international peacemaking tend to be too much in their heads and not enough in their hearts, I think. And the advice, and I would like to hear what my colleagues had to say about that, but I really do think that the work of the peacemaker is a work of the heart just as much as it is of the mind, and attending to the emotions, the identities, the respect issues, the justice issues that people are experiencing when they feel like violence is the only way that they have to respond to their environment is something that's oftentimes overlooked. And if there's a lesson to be learned here, I think it's something that more research and attention in terms of developing mediation and peacemaking processes must be attended to.
And last word, Mari Fitzstuff.
I think one of the things that horrifies me is the saying here, follow the money. We talk about a huge amount of money that's actually going in, $1,000 billion at least a year, going into how we can make war. Just listening to the three of us, we're all working in a system whereby very little money, very little time is actually put into how we make peace. And I think that is the saddest thing of all, that in fact we don't take it seriously. I think many of us hope that with a new regime it will be taken more seriously, there will be more resources put into it and save an awful lot of grief around the world.
That was Mari Fitstuff, Doug Fry, and Doug Knoll talking about the psychology of resolving global conflict. You can hear part two of that series this afternoon during the 4 p.m. show. After this short break, we'll be joined in studio by the actors and the playwright of Battle Hymn, so stay tuned.
This is Jim Lafferty inviting you to join me on the Lawyers Guild show this Thursday at 7 p.m. when my guest will be award-winning investigative journalist and author Robert Scheer. We'll be discussing his latest book, The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. It's a damning expose on the politics of war and defense spending, and an impassioned call for a new way of thinking about U.S. foreign policy. So join me and Robert Scheer this Thursday evening at 7 p.m. on the Lawyers Guild show, right here on Fiercely Independent KPFK.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Maria Armudian, sitting in for Sonali Kolhatkar. Imagine a pregnant teenager traveling from Kentucky to San Francisco who just can't bear to bring her baby into this troubled world. So she willfully carries and carries from the Civil War to the present day. That's the story of Bartha, who is abandoned by her father, separated from her lover in the new play called Battle Hymn, which is showing inside the Ford Theater. It's written by award-winning playwright Jim Leonard. It's a historical fantasy, and it features tragedy, humor, and hope as Martha travels across the painful history of the United States, one that is often forgotten and ignored. We're joined in studio now by playwright Jim Leonard and two of the actors, Susie Jane Hunt and Robert Manning Jr. Susie Jane Hunt, Robert Manning Jr., give us a taste of this.
Well, shoot, Lanford, give your weary dogs a rest and join me by the campfire. How the heck have you been? Tell me your tales.
We moved to Chicago, Detroit, and New York for a spell, but Henry never felt truly at home in the city. So we came out west seeking our fortune and fame.
Henry's dead, Lanford.
No, he's not. He's right here. I couldn't leave that big, lanky farm boy behind.
You got Henry in a suitcase. Oh, Lanford.
His leg bone, his arm bone, his finger bone with my wedding ring upon it.
You and Henry got hitched.
Ages ago.
You can't marry somebody who's dead.
In my country, you can marry whoever you want.
Are you pulling my leg?
Nope.
What if you want to marry a cow? I ain't saying I do, but what if I did?
Love is all you need.
Yeah, what if it's a girl cow?
Girls, boys, cows, people, trees, water, grass, sky, red, yellow, purple, blue, all love is holy. Ain't that right, Henrik? Are you feeling holy tonight? There's no killing allowed in my country, neither. We all live forever. Hi, Martha. How are you? I'm in a transcendental state.
Put poor Henry's head back in that suitcase. You're giving me the creeps.
Henry has been very concerned about you and his baby. He frets about you all the time. Ain't that right, Henry?
Henry's dead. He's not worried about anything, Lanford.
He is worried that somebody done put a spell on you.
Oh, you sound like a common yard darky.
You better hurry this labor along. You'll give birth to a teenager woman. Now, you can't carry on like this. It just ain't natural.
Do you think I like getting up 3-4 times a night to answer nature's call? I'm hungry. My back hurts. I'm constantly in tears about inconsequential things. I can't wait to have this baby so I can get my body back. Yes, I'm scared, and yes, I admit I'm a little bit picky and overprotective, but nobody wants this baby more than I do. I just have to find a safe place to raise it, that's all.
Mother. Mother! Well, Henry and I have had a long, heartfelt talk about this, and we firmly believe that you need to see a proper doctor.
A proper doctor let my mother bleed to death in childbirth. A proper doctor took me away from my mother and would not even permit her to hold me while she died, even though she cried out and begged for me.
Be that as it may, you cannot pretend that you're not pregnant.
Oh, don't give me the Harvard treatment, Lanford. I know my condition. Thanks to Mr. Bag of Bones over there. I know it in every fiber of my being, every moment of my life. Having a baby is who I am, Lanford. I know I'm not normal. I've always known that. I just wanted my kid to have a better shake than I did.
If you keep it inside you forever... It won't have any shake at all, Martha, good or bad.
Wow, what a beautiful dialogue. And Jim Leonard, the man who wrote this, is sitting right here with us, along with the actors. Thank you. That was beautiful, you guys.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you.
What compelled you to write this?
I was commissioned by South Coast Repertory Theater about 10 years ago to write a play on the Civil War. I wrote the first two-thirds of the first act and got stuck and put it away for almost a decade.
Amazing. And so this dialogue is far more than Civil War, clearly.
What I kept thinking about is a statement that Lincoln made one time. He talked about the terrifying promise of freedom. And I kept thinking about where we stand now and how much of what we are and who we are derives straight from the Civil War. Once you say all men are equal, it's such a radical concept that it extends beyond race into things like gay marriage.
Yeah, the themes are universal and timeless. And so what's interesting is that you've got this time travel, and yet the themes are timeless.
Well, I was trying to think of how do you bring the themes of the Civil War, the messages of the Civil War into present day, and I thought, well, let's just bring it into present day.
So, Sarah Jane Hunt, why don't you tell us about your character and your experience of being this character?
Okay, it's Susie Jane Hunt.
Susie Jane
Hunt. No worries.
See, I was not looking at my notes. I introduced you right.
Thank you. What was the question?
No, I wanted you to talk about the actual character and being this character and the encounters that you have. Talk about the encounters and being her.
Sure. Well, Martha is an incredibly strong young woman from the very start who becomes pregnant by her lover, her childhood love, you know, one of those people you've been in love with since you first met them. And she becomes pregnant and has to sort of stand up to her father, who is an Episcopalian minister, and gets sent away by him, and which is the beginning of this sort of epic journey throughout American history. And she comes across thieves and liars and rapists and then gets sucked into the Civil War and has to disguise herself as a male soldier in order to survive. So she's really all about survival and protecting her baby, and it becomes this sort of soul journey to find a safe place on Earth in order to have this child. And as she gets deeper and deeper into America, really, it becomes harder and harder to find that safe place. And so she sort of finds her own superpower, which is to keep the baby inside of her. And I think Jim has done a wonderful job of allowing the audience to just sort of go there with you. You know, I don't think you question ever that this girl is doing this and is actually going through this supernatural life, you know, in order to find a safe place on Earth. And that's where her journey starts and where it ends.
So it's a little bit harder to come by this safe place on Earth than what you would think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I also think that most women who are pregnant feel like they've been pregnant for about 150 years.
Well, let's bring Robert Manning Jr. into this. Now, you play more than one character.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us first about the main character, because that's the one that you are the most of the time.
Mostly Lanford. Yeah, Lanford is the one.
The lover's lover.
The lover's lover.
Explain that for our listeners so they can understand this.
Well, Susie's lover, Henry, which is played by Bill Heck, he impregnates her, so that's the father of her child. Well, he goes off to war, and he meets Lanford, which I play, and Henry and I fall in love. So when Susie finally finds the love of her life, the father of her child, she's surprised to find out that
he has a lover.
He has a lover who's a man.
Okay, so wait. So he's impregnated you, mm-hmm. but you have to find him later?
Yes, he leaves for the war right after I become pregnant. And so I am sent away by my father to have the child in a secret place, you know, but end up jumping off this train sort of and going off to find him, because that's what in the first act anyway, that's where I think my safe place is going to be.
Well, she wants the same thing that lots of people want, which is a partner, and mm-hmm. in her case she's thinking a husband and a nice house with a white fence around it and a safe place to have her kid.
Right.
And she's certain once she finds him, he'll do the right thing by her.
And yet he has actually fallen in love with another man.
Who happens to be black.
Who happens to be black.
In the Civil War times.
In the Civil War
which
times.
Which is huge.
Which is huge.
Which is huge.
Which is huge. Now, you play other characters, too.
Yeah, we play. It's really great because all the guys in the show, we kind of propel her into these different states of being. And through time. So in the beginning, I know when we first meet, I'm the butler. I'm kind of the house servant of the house. And then we meet, and I'm this thief. So we keep putting her in different states of being throughout the play. So it's really great. And then I play a cow. And I know a cow who moves, very specific moves. The moves are very specific, so it's not just like I'm a mooing cow. It really has intention and thought behind each move.
And what might that sound like? That's great. Thank you. Thank you for indulging
You're
me.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Jim Leonard, let's go back to this now. You put your character, Martha, through immense trials and tribulations. I mean, she's locked up in a psychiatric ward.
I mean,
she's all alone. She's 16. She's pregnant and vulnerable and banished by her father. And, I mean, come on. Can you give a girl a break?
No.
No. Well, part of the thought is that she has to grow up, and she eventually does. And she eventually, I think, becomes very much of an adult. And part of the thought is that the play operates on a bunch of levels, but the main level is the personal level for her as a character. And the larger sort of analogous level is our country, which I felt needed to grow up.
Yeah, the L.A. Times actually said, our nation has made great strides during the last 150 years in technology, infrastructure, and even fashion, but maybe not so much in terms of morality.
I think we have made huge strides in terms of morality. But the more moral we become, the more moral we want to become, which I think is part of that mountain.
So what it really is that you're speaking to is the layered, like going to deeper and deeper levels of morality.
I think so. And you know, if you think about it, every time we make a step forward, it's if you think of the pendulum of history, when it swings back, it becomes this horrible sword. So that soon after the slaves were freed, they were sharecroppers, and then Planned Parenthood was found to make sure that they didn't have too many children, and that came into being. Women couldn't vote for a long, long time. We're only just now on the precipice of gay rights.
And we finally have our African-American president.
Yes, which is huge, huge. It's a radically poetic concept.
So this is really a story of love and history, all wrapped up.
Yes.
All wrapped up here. Now, what is there significance of the places Kentucky and San Francisco?
Kentucky was a place that remained technically neutral during the Civil War, but it was a slave state at the same time. And President Lincoln said to all the states, if you don't leave the Union, you can keep your slaves. So there were slaves in Maryland and Delaware and even Washington, D.C. up until 1867, 2 years after the war ended.
In San Francisco.
And San Francisco just struck me and strikes me as the iconic summer of love, the time of great, great hope. And, of course, then it turned into the 80s.
Oh, right. Well, I also, we have some tickets to give away to our listeners, so I would like for listeners that are interested in going to Sunday showing, which is actually a day.
The Robert, 2 p.m. show, the matinee show is Pay What You Can.
The matinee show is Pay What You Can. Yeah. And but we've got five pairs of tickets to give away if you would like to get them. And that number here is 818-985-KPFK, which is 818-985-5735 if you would like to get tickets. Robert Manning, I've got you all confused. Jim Leonard, you've got some information about where it is.
Well, also you can – it's at the Ford Theater inside the Ford, which is a little intimate 90-seat proscenium theater under the Ford. It's a great space. You can get tickets by going to www.fordtheaters.org. That's fordtheaters.org.
With plural, fordtheaters.
Exactly.
.org.
Or you can call 323-461-3673.
All right. That's great. So we're speaking now with Jim Leonard and two of the actors, the star of the show, Susie Jane Hunt, not Sarah Jane Hunt, and Robert Manning Jr., who, in addition to playing her lover's lover, is also
a cow.
Among other things.
Yes.
And so I want to say thank you to all of you for coming and being with us and sharing your talent with
with us here in studio and with our listeners.
Thank you very much.
Can we
mention the other two, the other three actors?
Please do.
There's also Bill Heck, wonderful actors, William Sawyers and John Short. And they also play multiple characters.
It's a really great group of people.
Directed by John Langs.
Yes, thank you.
Who did a fantastic job.
He was the best director ever.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And now we're going to go to the subversive thought for the day. And this is Kenneth Tynan, who once said, "No theater could sanely flourish until there was an umbilical connection between what was happening on the stage and what was happening in the world." That's Kenneth Tynan, and that is Uprising's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Sonali Kohatkar is the host and co-producer. Jazz Shepherd is our engineer. Gabriel San Roman is the producer, and Rose Reed is our intern. I'm Maria Armudi, and I'm sitting in for Sonali today and next Tuesday. You can hear an audio stream of this program after 10 a.m. today on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. Thanks for listening. See you Tuesday at 8.